All right, real good. Very good. Good morning, guys. This is Solder Smoke. Pete, what number is it?
Number 262, and for those at the undisclosed location, crank it in. Crank it in.
Crank it in. We'll have more about crank it in a minute. And good morning to you, Dean. Good.
Good
How are
morning,
things
good
there
morning.
in Great Falls?
It's a cold Great Falls morning. What can I say?
Oh.
How is it down the road?
It's okay here too. Temperature is 5 degrees centigrade.
There you
All right, Pete, how are things in California?
Well, they're alerting us we're supposed to get 2 inches of rain tomorrow. And 2 inches of rain is significant.
I know you're gonna,
Significant.
but you gotta watch it because soon you'll be talking on the air about cutting the lawn and raking the leaves. And that's not a good sign. All right, guys. So listen, we got some good news this morning. We're over 100. I think we're at 104 on the direct conversion receiver builds around the world. And Dean and I talked about the receiver, the direct conversion receiver, to the GQRP Club, which was quite an honor, actually. Pete, I know you've done it many times, but we did it, and it was great fun. We have a link to it up on the blog, and you could check it out. So Dean, any comments on the progress of the direct conversion receiver project?
Sure. I mean, we've talked about this before. I think when you and I first discussed, you asked me how many I thought we'd get. I said maybe a dozen. So now that we're up to 104 and more apparently on the way, it's very pleasing. Those are the ones that have been reported to us. I keep hearing about clubs that have built it, but I haven't seen any evidence that seven or eight have done. But if we get some of those, that'll boost the numbers too. But it's just gratifying. I think what has surprised me a bit is how successful the little things that we've done, the videos explaining the boards, making sure that the schematics are up to date. You and I being on there and answering questions early on was really important. But now there's kind of a community there that kind of picks up and answers the questions for us. And that's actually been nice because early on, it was quite time consuming. It was kind of a full-time job for a few
Yeah,
weeks there.
it was, and I think one of the more gratifying things for me about it has been how many of these guys who started out sort of skeptical about our kind of homebrew ethos. Why don't you make it a kit? Why do I have to struggle to get the parts? Why do I have to do Manhattan boards? Why do I have to do four separate boards? In the end, they all came around and sort of like, okay, I get it now. I understand it. This is the first time I've homebrewed anything. And it's worthwhile to do it this way. It's better than doing it as a kit. So I thought that was very gratifying too. Pete, you've been sort of on the sides of this because of family responsibilities, but what are your observations on the whole thing?
Oh, I think it's amazing. And what wouldn't surprise me is clubs will take this on and it may show up in 4 days in May.
Yep, you never know.
Yeah, you never know. As a matter of fact, when I had the LBS project, a club from Canada built a whole bunch of these and took them to FDIM. They won the prize. So they can see the value in it. So I wouldn't be surprised. I'll be watching next year's at 4 days in May. Direct conversion receivers are going to show up there. That's what happens when you have 104 built units.
That's really good. We've got kind of mixed results with group builds because they start out with a lot of enthusiasm, but then we kind of don't hear anything about it. So I think it would be good to do this. We had that one group up in New Hampshire that actually followed through that did in the maker space that they had up there, really came through and had three successful builds. Three out of three, I think, was really good. Or four out of four, I think it was four out of four. So that was really good. The other thing I want to mention here at the intro was the geomagnetic storm that really began on the night of November 11th and 12th. I hadn't been following this too much because, cycle, it's like, as Pete has pointed out, cycle 25, it happens
What
a
cycle
lot.
25?
Yeah, it happens a lot. But this one was pretty bad. It was a G4 storm. And it happened on the night that my daughter was flying from the East Coast back to San Francisco. She sent us a picture of Aurora that they saw. They must have seen it from like when they were flying over the plains. And it was quite dramatic. But I got up the following morning and I'm sitting here in front of the computer and I look down to the lower right. I'm pointing here right now, lower right. On the computer screen where it gives you the date and time. And I know that it's like the morning of the 12th, and it's early, it's 5 a.m., but it's showing that it's the evening of the 11th at 10:29 p.m.
Ooh.
So the whole thing kind of froze up. It had never done this before. Nothing was broken. I just turned off the computer and turned it on again, which is, of course, what you do in almost all these circumstances. But it just, for me, it was I kind of connected it to the geomagnetic activity, which was quite pronounced because of the
You
coronal mass ejection.
don't think it's the radio gods rebelling at direct conversion receivers.
No, I don't think it's that. I don't think
Okay,
it's
that's
that.
good.
There's another thing that happened that was interesting. Right around the same time, on the same day, there was a countrywide blackout in the Dominican Republic. We started getting reports that the entire country was blacked out, with the exception of the eastern area, the tourist area where we are. So it was okay for us, but the rest of the country was in bad shape. Now, they've sort of analyzed what happened, and they think that it was sort of a problem with one of the major relays in the transmission system went bad. But I don't know. It sounds like a strange coincidence to me that
Yeah.
it
Carrington effect. Carrington effect.
a
Yeah.
Carrington effect. Yeah, I mean, and
I
we've
don't
seen this before. The great blackout in New York was triggered by solar activity. So there's a lot of stuff. I mean, it could be that you would get like a loss in the transmission system, some relay would kick out, but it would have been what provoked it.
Cascades.
What provoked it was, yeah, could have been the geomagnetic activity. So.
Bill, we had brownouts in St. Michael's on the Eastern Shore. And I'd never been in a brownout before. The lights dim, but they don't go out. They
Oh
kind of
man.
flicker. It's kind of ghosty. Got up in the morning, microwave oven was dead.
Oh man.
Dead.
Killed by a brownout.
Controller board was killed.
Oh
So
God. Yeah.
didn't lose any of the other electronics. Ham gear's fine, but microwave oven bit the dust.
Oh man. All right. So I hope you got that. I know you got that replaced. That's good.
We're going Monday. They're finally, it's been delayed because of our New York trip.
All
So,
right. Okay. You were up in New York. I was out in Lexington. A lot of travel going on. We're all back at post right now. Pete, over to you.
good morning, everybody from the left coast, and I have just a few items. First, I want to recognize the 250th birthday of the United States Marine Corps this past Monday on November the 10th. I serve with those guys at Chulai, and they have my greatest admiration and respect. Semper Fi, really great, great organization, always at the forefront of things. And I guess the thing that struck me is next year is going to be the 250th anniversary of the United States, 1776 to 2026. So it's going to be a big celebration next year. But recognize the Marine Corps. For their 250th birthday. And when they celebrate, they really know how to celebrate. Did you see some of that when you were in the embassies?
Every year we would have the Marine Corps ball. It was like the it was sort of
Yeah.
like the sort of like the senior prom of the embassies, and
Yeah.
you'd go to the thing. It was always a lot of fun. It was always a great event. Elisa went with me to many events there in Santo Domingo and in other places too. So it was great fun.
Yeah, super. The next subject I want to just cover real quickly in passing is Thanksgiving coming up. And even though the government shutdown was ended yesterday, a lot of people have been affected, and a lot of people are still being affected. And please don't forget those people. And cash donations are the best. So, whatever your favorite organization is, a food bank, a church organization, Salvation Army, reach into your pocket. It doesn't cost that much to provide them a meal and at least give them something. But there are people here in the United States that are hungry. It's hard to believe, but it's a reality and a fact. And so if you go to, instead of buying $100 worth of parts, put $100 somewhere that's going to do some good, and at least someone's going to have a nice Thanksgiving. So please don't forget those people. Very, very important. I stopped by our local Catholic church here and dropped a check off for St. Vincent de Paul. And they shared with me they have seen a dramatic increase in requests for help and assistance, biggest spike that they've ever seen. And so it's a reality. There are people out there that are suffering, so don't forget them. So behind me is the hybrid wireless, and this project is something that started actually 50 years ago. There's an aluminum plate in there that most of the electronics is mounted on. Was a transceiver that I started back in 1970. Didn't work too well, so I strip all the parts off and I kept the plate. And then about 2 years ago, I decided to try to get it working. And then finally, I said, I need to do something more with it, and I put it in a box. And it's been a real learning experience, but at the same time, it's been very gratifying to see the thing work. There's some YouTube videos on the hybrid wireless, and it really works pretty good. I mean, the receive is very, very good, and I've had a few things that I had to deal with in technical things to deal with in the transmit part. First thing is the JF3 HZB circular dial. I had to get rid of that, and I'll tell you why. It looks really, really nice, but in the software, they used code for the SI5351 that's not normally what we use. It seems like the standard is NT7S Jason Meldrum's SI5351 code, and that seems to be adopted by everybody. That code doesn't exist in that, and it was really hard to set the BFO frequency. So when you set the BFO frequency, the dial wasn't reading right. So you had some real problems between those two, and it just didn't sound right. So I said, okay, basta. I pulled it out, and I put a nano in there, and I put the SI, the LII 9341 display in there, and I was able to accurately set the SI5351 correction factor, and sounds a lot better, and you get a lot better signal reports. And a few other things I had to chase down. I bought one of those 300-fold DC supplies from Amazon that was too good to be true, $29, and had that integrated in the power supply. And I noticed at low volume levels, I was hearing this noise, not atmospheric noise, but noise. And I traced it to that supply, so I pulled that out and I built a separate supply, and that cured that. And then most recently, you can read it on my blog entry today. The tube that was in there, the 12GE5, the final, I had it biased a little too high because I was trying to get more watts out of it, so I had it right on the leading edge. And I did so much tuning with the thing that you could start to see the performance of the tube was going down, so I put a second tube in there. And that's when I discovered that the first tube accidentally was good enough with regard to its specs to not create a problem with regard to neutralization. So then I was noticing that when I put the second tube in there, I was looking at the output, and every once in a while on voice peaks, you'd see this hinky little thing appear, burble appear on the output. So I said, you know what? I bet you I need to neutralize this thing. So I added some neutralization, and that solved the hinky looks on the display. And the other thing too is now the band pass seems to have flattened out a lot. So there's much to be said for neutralization. So if you look at my blog entry for today, you'll see about neutralization and why you want to do it and how you go about doing it. And it was very successful. So I'm going to be doing a little more testing on that. But it's interesting to see when you use a radio like this, that does not have an analog VFO. You set the step tuning rate, say at 1 kilohertz or 100 hertz. You find that stations are not on frequency. They could be 50 hertz high or 50 hertz low, and it all has to do with mathematics. So if you're incrementing your frequency at 1 kilohertz, if someone is slightly off, you'll tune up to the next value. Now the screen just disappeared. Oh, there we are. We're back again. So maybe I said hertz and the screen went blank. But anyway, a lot of it depends upon what you have your step tuning rate. Your BFO could be off 49 hertz, and while your display says you're on frequency, you're actually not, because it doesn't kick over. So if you're like 53 hertz, it would connect to click over to the next kilohertz. Now, 50 hertz is down in the weeds. And of course, with an analog VFO, you just tune it till it sounds best. But with the step tuning rate, you're going to either get the 100 hertz before, 100 hertz after, but you're somewhere in between. So I just wonder what these guys are doing. I mean, one guy said to me, you're 40 hertz high or 50 hertz high. He says, wait a minute. He has a GPS locked frequency standard that he measured. He says, you're 49 hertz, 49 hertz high. So you can't hardly tell a difference that you're 49. If you're 200 or 300 hertz, your ear can detect that. But I mean, the ear, just close your eyes and tuning it, you'll get pretty close. So I think because they have the capability to measure these things, we see that they're doing that and then telling you, oh, you're off frequency, because everything's tend to be channelized. Go ahead, Dean, you're about to say
Well,
something.
I don't think him having a GPS tuned frequency standard helps at all with determining what frequency you're on when you're talking on SSB. I don't think it does anything
Yeah,
for him.
I don't
So
either,
I don't.
because here's why. Because he can't see your carrier. And what the frequency readout is measuring is the location of your carrier, your suppressed carrier, your disappeared carrier that he can't see. If we were talking about AM, we could say, okay, your
Yeah.
carrier's here and your carrier's right at the same frequency. But you can't see his carrier, even if you have a web SDR or a waterfall, and he can't see yours. So you're just guesstimating. And because I have the same problem with my analog VFOs, but it the so the problem exists with analog VFOs also, because I have one of these cheapo PLJ frequency counters in there, and it only registers down to 100 hertz. So when I have it set at 14.253.0, it could be anywhere within 100 hertz of there, right? It
Yeah,
could be
yeah,
at the high
yeah.
end or the low end. But I had a guy, and Pete, this just came just on the heels of your being told that I think you were 50 hertz off.
49, 49.
I had a guy come back to me and very, very confidently say, "Well, that homebrew rig sounds okay, but I think you've got some problems with it, old man, because I'm showing you," he said, actually said 30 hertz off, 30 hertz. So I went back to him and I said, "How do you know that I'm 30 hertz off?" Because I said, "Because I don't really know what your voice sounds like, and you don't really know what my voice sounds like." I said, "I'm tuning you in pretty much by ear, and I might not understand. Your voice might be higher or lower in pitch than
Right.
I imagine." This brings me back to an article that appeared in one of the radio magazines about the old sideband dinners when sideband was new. And they talked about how guys would laugh at the dinners when they would meet somebody that they had been talking to on the air on single sideband for a long time. And they would laugh and they would say, "Oh man, I always thought you had a lower voice than you have, or I always thought you had a higher voice,"
Right.
because they were not tuning it in precisely. Now, one other comment about this. When this guy told me that, I said to him, "How do you know?" And he said, "Oh, well, I have headphones." Okay, great.
Okay.
But I said I wasn't going to argue with him on the air or anything. But afterwards, I did an experiment, and I went to a web SDR, the one, the NA5B that's owned by Mehmet, which is right here in Northern Virginia. And I went to 20 meters. This was before the geomagnetic storm. 20 meters was still functioning. And I tuned in some signals, and I knew that these guys were on the integer increment of the signal. They were on 14.253, boom. So there they were, and I could see them. And also, a lot of these guys were modulating right down to the carrier frequency. In other words, they were not paying attention to the don't waste your energy on 0 to 300 hertz. They were going right down to zero. So
Gotta have
I
those lows.
got
Gotta
to
have
have those
those
lows.
lows.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I was able to say, okay, this guy's at 14.253, and I'm listening to him on the web SDR, and I can understand him just fine. So then I go ahead on the web SDR and I tune up 30 hertz, and I say, "Can I notice a difference?" I can do that on the web SDR in a way that I can't do on my homebrew rig, because I could just set it at 14.253.030. Okay, there it is, 30 hertz up, or 30 hertz down, 30 hertz down from that. I could not tell the difference. I went to 50 hertz. I couldn't tell the
Yeah.
difference. I went to 100 hertz, maybe at 100 hertz, definitely at 200 or 300 hertz, but not at 30 hertz, no. And I don't, I think Dean's right. I think having the GPS
Locked.
coordinated, say, it's not going to help with the fundamental problem that we can't see each other's carriers, right?
Okay,
So.
there's something else that's going on here too. So the fast Fourier transform puts your signal into these little bins. There's an error bar in there, right? You're not ever gonna get a precise laboratory tuned frequency out of an amateur radio signal. I mean, we're just the tools are not built for that level of precision. And you know, if you're down to tens of hertz, as Pete said, the algorithm in the software may be affecting it. The algorithm in the PLL, the phase lock loop frequency generator, may not be precise down to 10 hertz. There may be a little bit of drift, and as you said, Bill, you can't hear it anyway. So it's I think we saw this with the direct conversion receiver as well, where there's a fundamental lack of understanding about how sideband works and what you're actually doing. And the fact is, if you're off by 100 hertz, that just means you've shifted the pitch by 100 hertz. Now, when you get too far off, it starts to sound like Donald Duck because you're not really on frequency. But when you're within the range, it's just a higher pitch or a lower pitch. As you said, you don't know what they sound like. And you know, I've played around and okay, oh, that guy sounds pretty good. Oh, maybe his voice is a little pinched, and you turn it and it sounds a little deeper, and it's like, who knows?
Yeah, and the other thing is, a lot of guys seem to resent the fact that they have to tune the clarifier. You know, they have a knob on there called the
Ooh.
RIT or the clarifier. That's what it's there for, right? If you don't like the pitch, just turn it around a little bit till you like the sound, right? But I mean, I don't know.
And they discount the possibility that what they're using is off frequency. In other words, they're saying, my radio says you're off, but your radio may be off.
It could be,
Yeah.
yeah. It could be, and in any case, it doesn't really matter. So
Yeah.
it doesn't matter anyway.
All right.
We will
So
continue to be 50 hertz. Wait,
next
wait
up
a
on the
second.
bad
Dave,
guy
Pete,
list.
wait. Pete's got something.
I got one more item, and I don't know if this is bogus or not, but recently, I've received a whole bunch of requests for QSL cards from an outfit called QSL World. Never heard of QSL World, and they all seem to be from South America. And initially, I thought someone was bootlegging my call, but they're contacts that occurred in 2015, 2014. Have you guys heard of this QSL World? All of a sudden, I get this whole slew of requests for QSL cards from like Chile, Argentina, Venezuela, Colombia, and one or two here in the States, and I've never heard of this QSL world. So, anybody hear anything about it? I've
No, I
not
haven't.
responded to anything. I looked at it and said, wait a minute, I don't recognize that call. And then from QS, you know, QSOs that took place 10 years ago.
No, there's a lot of people who just suddenly decided they want to be the next QRZ.com and make some money. Anything.
Yeah, there you
I
go.
don't know. So
Okay,
I
I'm done.
okay. Dean, tell us about the 100 watt amplifier. Let me start out by saying Dean has stepped into the breach here. He has done something that Pete and I have really not dared to do, and that is build a solid state 100 watt linear amplifier. I've not done it. I've always chickened out. I always end up going with the CCI kit. Pete, I don't think
Perhaps
you've done it either.
I should have chickened out. I don't know.
But you didn't.
It's
So
been
you
months.
have our admiration. But go ahead, tell us, give us a tale of woe here,
Well, while I'm
Pete.
talking, if you enable sharing, I'll put up the picture of the thing of beauty itself.
Hold on.
Yeah, so this has been a real journey. Okay, you've started screen share. No, you're sharing. You need to enable sharing. We don't need to see your Google screen.
I don't
Bill,
know.
you got to hide your search history, man.
Hold on.
It's
Let's
been a
check it.
journey. I mean, MOSFET amplifiers are intuitively simple to understand. They have you know, an input circuit which you have to match some impedance with some transformation. You got the bias circuit where you set the bias of the transistors. You got an output circuit where you got to take the output impedance and match it to 50 ohms. And that's it. And if you look at schematics of MOSFET amplifiers and you strip away things that are not necessary for the basic amplification, like a lot of them will have, all kinds of SWR protection circuitry in them, or some will be self-biasing, or they'll have temperature compensation. But if you strip all that off of a schematic, they all look basically the same. You got a transformer, and you got two MOSFETs, and you got a transformer, and you got the output, and everything else is so they seem simple, right? They seem simple, but there is a danger in that simplicity. We get a lot as home brewers who are have been working on the cheap with IRF 510s. We get certain habits built into our built into the way we build amplifiers. So for an IRF 510, for example, if you push the bias up to say a little over 4.5 volts, poof, the thing will just smoke on you. So it's very sensitive because it's a switching transistor. It's not really an RF amplifier. So that has been in the back of my head. Be careful. Don't smoke these transistors. And
I think you
these
could
trans
share. I think you could share now, Dean.
okay, and these transistors that I am using are not cheap. They're $50 a piece. They're RF transistors. They're Mitsubishi 100 watt transistors. So I don't want to smoke them. I did smoke one early on from some dumb construction, and I had just a lot of problems when I first built it. It had kind of worked pretty well up to about 14 megahertz, and then it just kind of died after that. And as I reported last time, I was just struggling and struggling with it. I got some advice from many, many people who are vastly more experienced in building these kind of things than I am. One of them was, well, you're never going to get it working on a Manhattan style. You're going to have to go to a manufactured PCB with, multiple layers and all of this kind of stuff. Another one was, well, your leads are just too long, everything's too long, or you're not using RF capacitors in the right places. Allison, KB1GMX, was very helpful. She looked at the design. She recommended that I go back to Mitsubishi's reference design and build it as close to that as possible. She made the good point that they built it and they showed you a picture of it, and theirs works and yours doesn't. So there's got to be something going on there. And that was helpful. I even got help from none other than WA2EUJ Jim Veach. And Jim Veach has won the ARL Homebrew Challenge at least 3 times for his design of amplifiers. And he was gracious enough to hop on a Zoom call with me and walk through my amplifier build and give me a whole bunch of hints. And largely as a result of his and Allison's guidance, I rebuilt the amplifier from scratch. And what you're seeing now is the rebuilt amplifier. The prior build had the red DC wires that you see out there. It had traces on the board where the DC was running all around the board. Jim made the point that that was breaking up the ground plane of the board. Further, he recommended that I really ought to put the ground plane. So, where you can't really tell from looking at this from the top, everywhere there's a ground a lead, it's actually drilled through and soldered on the bottom. So the bottom is a complete uninterrupted ground plane. So now we have a much better ground plane. Allison recommended that I solder the transformers directly to the PCB rather than use leads. So you'll see they're sitting right on there. And those transformers are commercial transformers from Communications Concepts, the same one that Bill, you use in your CCI amplifier, and Pete. So I've got the right transformers in there, and they're soldered down. So the leads, particularly facing the transistors, are really, really short. The feedback circuit, which goes from the drains to the gates, I have now the resistors and the capacitor directly on top of the transistor, so they're no longer. So you'll see in the significant RF sections of this amplifier, there's no long leads. There's no place for very little few places for interference to creep in. Those were kind of the big physical changes I made as I rebuilt this amplifier. It certainly looks cleaner now, and it's easy to see. But you know what? It still wasn't working. It was incrementally better, but it was not working at 28 megahertz. And people say, oh, well, the performance always falls off at 28 megahertz. No, these are transistors that are designed to work well beyond that. And the demonstration circuit for Mitsubishi works. They have all the data published on their demonstration circuit. They're not using any more complex components than I am. And one of the things that Allison suggested is that I put surface mount caps, RF caps, on the output transformer and on the drains to ground. So you could probably see at the transistor end of the output transformer, you can probably see the surface mount caps that are soldered there. And I had noticed that they had done that in the Mitsubishi design. So I tried to do all of those things. But at the end of the day, those were not the things that were significantly affecting the amplifier. The thing that was significantly affecting the amplifier was my fear of having the bias too high. I had these amplifiers work well when they're biased closer to an amp, and I was biasing them at 400 milliamps. So I had the bias low, kind of barely conducting. And what happens when the bias is too low is the MOSFET transconductance varies with the drain current. So if you have a higher bias current, you have a higher transconductance, you have a lower input impedance. Of course, below the threshold, the thing is off completely. Above the threshold, you have higher transconductance and lower input impedance. So you can see, if you think about it from that point of view, that having the bias set in the right linear range of the amplifier is really important in order to get it to work properly. Because otherwise, it's not operating at spec. You're operating below spec and it's not working that well. The other thing that happens is that the gate source capacitance changes with bias. At low bias, with these particular transistors, it's maybe 400 picofarads. At high bias, it's maybe 700 picofarads. So that's going to affect the input impedance. Everything is dependent on having that bias set. So I got help with this from Claude.ai. I spent a lot of time asking a bunch of questions. Claude got some things that I knew were right wrong, but I corrected those, and in its obsequious way, it said, "Oh yes, you're absolutely right. I miscalculated the impedance transformation ratio of that transformer. You are correct. Let me redo the calculation for you." It's like, stop giving me cookies. Just give me advice. And anyway, with the help of Claude, I basically at the end said, I've tried this, I've tried that, I've tried that. And basically it said, well, you've verified that the input transformer works. You've verified that the output transformer works. You've verified this, you've verified that. It said, the only thing left is look at the bias and make sure you're biased in the right region. And sure enough, I had biased it too low. And I actually asked Claude to tell me what the bias was. It went and fetched the spec sheet on the transistor, did the calculation, looked at the curves, and recommended the bias level. And when I turned the bias level up, boom, suddenly the thing is working at 10 meters. Now, there is
That's
some
really
falloff,
impressive. I mean,
but
that's some impressive AI-assisted troubleshooting right
oh
there.
my gosh, yeah. And part of it was my bias, which is those transistors are going to pop if I run them too hot. And the other issue was, when you're troubleshooting, you don't think about those things that are, quote, working, right? So if it's working, you're not thinking about it. But the truth is it wasn't working. It's just I thought it was working and I was wrong. So there we have it. Next steps, I need to put a relay on there, a bypass relay for receive. It's sitting on top of the box that it's going to go in, and the box is perfectly sized. I've been thinking about how to mount that heat sink to the bottom of the box. I think I'm just going to use some little angle brackets screwed to the heat sink and screwed to the bottom of the box. I'm going to put some blinking lights on there to so I can see when it's on and when it's in transmit. I've got low pass filters built already, and I'm close. This week I should have it on the air and be enjoying it. So that's been the journey of the 100 watt amplifier. I'm pretty pleased with where I have come out.
Pete, I think we need to do this. If Dean can do it, we can. We should follow his lead.
Yeah.
If you already have the amplifier working in your shack, I don't know,
I don't know. I mean, it makes me feel like an appliance operator,
Hey, Dean, I want to share a story with you because I think you can relate to this. Back in the early 2000s, I decided it was time to construct a big linear amplifier. So I have sitting in my garage a 3CX1500A7 amplifier. It's good for 1.5 kW out, key down. And so I started building this thing, and I said, I can do it cheaper than buying one. Well, after putting $3,000 into it, I had a one band amplifier, and to put multiple bands on it, this band switch was going to be another $300. And everything else, I said, you dummy. I could at that point in time, I could have bought a solid state amplifier for a lot less money. So today, I'm fearful of turning that thing on because there's 3,000 volts in the power supply. But I'm saying, boy, what did you do? Sometimes it was a good learning experience, and you can sit back and say, well, the next one, I don't know exactly what to do. But you look at the cost sometimes and say, geez.
Well,
Did you
no,
run
the
into that?
yeah, the you know the transistors are expensive to begin with. So you start with the fact that we're used to working with couple dollar parts. So now you start working with $50 parts. If I could burn up a few couple dollar parts, I could burn up 10 of them and I wouldn't feel too bad. But I burned up one of these, I did something dumb. I was hand holding a capacitor on the drain circuit, and I managed to blow the transistor, and that made me put the thing away for a couple of weeks in shame, and then I got it back out, ordered another transistor, put it back in. But by the time I was all said and done with the commercial transformers, and I actually hand wound some transformers and used those, and my guess is now that I have the basic thing down, I could replace these transformers with my own. It would work fine. But along the way, it's like, all right, well, let me get the transformers from CCI. Let's eliminate that as an issue. So I didn't particularly save any money. And by the time I get the enclosure and the heat sink and everything else in place, and it certainly took me way longer to do than it would have if I just, bought the CCI and put a kit. But that's not why I do this, right?
Are
I mean,
you learning?
I did this because I wanted to learn, and I wanted to understand, and I wanted to continue to improve my technical skills and my building skills. I'm not a trained RF engineer or an electrical engineer. As I think everybody knows, I'm a software guy. And so a lot of this, in the last 5 or 6 years has been brand new to me. And so, I take some satsatisfaction in knowing that I have
Oh
built
yeah,
this thing,
absolutely.
no, you should take a lot
and
of
I understand it
satisfaction.
now.
Congratulations. It's a real triumph, and I'm not kidding when I think, well, we should move into the homebrew solid state amplifier world,
There you go. There you go.
Pete. Well, there's a Facebook group, RF amplifiers, power amplifiers, but these are I want to say they're CB guys who are building, way illegal amplifiers. I mean, many thousands of watts.
They
And so
start at 2.5 kilowatts.
I went on there to ask for some advice, and I started looking at what they were building. And I'm like, they're gonna look at this and they're just gonna laugh at me. And I'm like, all right, I'm not even gonna enter their realm.
Well, there's something to be said for not entering the realm of 1.5 kilowatts or kilovolts.
Right.
Holy cow. Boom. I don't know. A solid state, I think, is the way to go. Anyway, congratulations, Dean. Thanks for sharing
Nice
that with us.
build, nice build. I was really looking at your board very closely, and I just wonder if your original prototype amplifier, if you'd up the bias, would it have worked?
I suspect it would have, but it's all disassembled now. So, and
Yeah.
I'm not gonna put it back
Yeah,
together to test
yeah, yeah, yeah.
it.
And three cheers for Claude, that's a pretty good troubleshoot assist there. That's good.
Yeah, it's of the AI assistants, it is got a recommendation. It's got the reputation as being kind of the best in for technical subjects like this. Or among the best. It was started by the guys at Anthropic that spun out of OpenAI.
Well, when you mentioned the troubleshooting procedure, it brings to mind the book by Jim Pease that was recommended to me. I'll mention it in the mailbag. But one of the points he makes was that very often during a troubleshooting process, there'll be a list of things that couldn't possibly be causing the problem. And usually the problem will be in that list. So they don't look at those things because, well, they couldn't possibly be causing the
Yeah.
problem. So there
That's
seems to
exactly what I was trying to say, Bill.
be. Well, good for Jim Pease. All right. And good for three cheers for Claude and three cheers for you, Dean. Hey, Pete, what, you got something else?
Shameless Commerce Division.
That's right. That's what time it is. It's time for Shameless Commerce Division. And we got to mention mostly DIY RF up there in the Silicon Forest of Portland, Oregon. Todd is toiling away up there, and all kinds of good offerings from the mostly DIY RF site. I did some organization of the blog, and I think his link is still on there. And so you could just click on that and get to the site. If not, just plug into your search engine, mostly DIY RF, and it'll take you to the fantastic world of Todd's kits, parts. Great stuff. Anyway, the other thing I would ask everybody to do is become a solder smoke patron. We've been kind of under the gun here, and we'll talk about this. We'll talk about our NIMCEL status here in a little while, but we're kind of under the same gun that a lot of people in the internet are under because of things like AI. I mean, there's good and there's bad. We're feeling the consequences of the kind of the bad part of it. And anyway, being a patron through the Patreon system really helps us kind of compensate for that. So please consider becoming a Solder Smoke patron. And then finally, buy stuff through the Amazon link on the right-hand column of the Solder Smoke page. These brings us these kinds of purchases bring us what we've come to call Bezos bucks, right, Pete? Bezos bucks. He sends us a small portion. So if you want to buy something, especially if you're going to buy something really kind of expensive, a
McLaren,
Lamborghini,
a
go Italian, buy a
McLaren.
Lamborghini. And anyway, or a big expensive spectrum analyzer or something like that, do that. You could buy it through the Amazon site. Just click on the link, then do your shopping as normal, and we get a piece of the action from that. So thanks very much for doing that.
Hey, Bill, I've been having a little fun calling it Bozos because it's a combination of Bojack
I
and
caught
Bezos.
that. Yeah. I think we've all become skeptical about BoJack. I
Yeah.
find myself reaching into the parts bin every once in a while and discovering, wait a second, they're BoJack. I don't know. I don't know. All right, so now it's my portion. I have up on the blog page, on the Solder Smoke Blogspot page, and I'll put it on. I don't think it'll show up in the show notes, but if you want to take a look at that, there's a calculator online that tells you where your antipode is. Where is the place on the Earth that is exactly on the opposite side? And so I plugged in my Virginia location, and it gave me the antipode, which is somewhere to the southwest of Western Australia, that bottom tip, that bottom corner. You'll see it on the blog. That is as far as I can go. And if we go any further in that direction, we're coming back around the other side. It's about 12,000 miles away. So I don't know. I kind of get a kick out of working stations at that location. I know if we go long path to South Africa, for example, it's a lot longer than short path to South Africa. When you're out there at the antipode, there's no real difference between long path and short path. It doesn't matter. But I've been getting up early in the morning and working VKs. I especially like working the VK6. I talked to VK6 Alpha Charlie Fox. Charlie, and he's Alpha Charlie Fox. His name is Charlie, and his distance, according to QRZ.com, is 11,629 miles from me, which is, I think, pretty good. He might be the most distant station that I've worked. I mean, if you look where the antipode is, it's way out there in the middle of the ocean. And the closest land station is probably where Charlie is, 11,629 miles. I've also, and this is before the geomagnetic storm, been picking up some really interesting South Pacific stations. Echo 5-1 Mike Whiskey Alpha. You know, we were Dean and I were joking. We were talking to Echo 5-1 Juliet Delta Jim down there in Rarotonga regularly. But you get up early in the morning, Jim is there, and it was always a great pleasure to talk to him. But I was
Do
surprised one
you
morning.
have your war award worked all Rarotonga?
I'm in the running for the Worked All Rarotonga Award, but this is an expansion of that, the Cook Islands Worked All Cook Islands Award. So a de-expedition showed up there, and one morning I heard the Echo 5-1 call sign. I figured, wow, somebody is on Rarotonga. No. Echo 5-1 Mike Whiskey Alpha is in the North Cook Islands. Jim is in the South Cook Islands, you see. And the North Cook Islands counts as a separate DXCC entity. So I talked to them and managed to work them. Also worked Fox Whiskey 5 Kilo, which is on a really bizarrely named place. I don't even have it in the notes here, but you guys can look it up. It sounds so strange. It sounds even rarer than Rarotonga. Anyway, all of this has been done with homebrew SSB transmitters, and that sort of adds to the kind of the attraction to doing this. It's kind of fish in a barrel when it's FT8 using an ICOM 7300, okay? But it's a different story when it's a homebrew rig in a wooden box and you're using it to talk to Fox Whiskey 5 Whiskey or Echo 5-1 Mike Whiskey Alpha. So that's been a lot of fun. I want to follow up with something that I mentioned from the Dominican Republic when I was down there. I mentioned that I was hearing an FM broadcast station from Puerto Rico, where our location in the Dominican Republic is on the eastern tip of the island. So Puerto Rico is only 100 miles away to the east. And so I was hearing W, what is it? WIDI. At 99.5 FM. It's kind of an oldies rock station, so I kind of like the content. And it was coming through quite strong all summer. And so it actually caused me to wonder whether this was tropo or whether this was just, kind of refractive line of sight. And no, I think it was tropo because a tropical storm moved through the area. And I noticed that when the tropical storm went right through the Mona Passage, the signal almost completely disappeared. It was significantly down. So that's for me an indication that it is tropo. But this made me think perhaps I can kerchunk the Puerto Rican repeaters on the western portion of the island of Puerto Rico from the Dominican Republic. So I have we're going to be heading back down to the Dominican Republic in December, and I'm going to bring with me some 2 meter gear, some 2 meter FM gear. Including an amplifier, and I might get a directional antenna and just aim it out over the water, aim it at Puerto Rico, and see if I can work some Puerto Rican repeaters on the other side of the Mona Passage, which would be fun.
What do you think the distance is?
It's 100 miles.
100 miles, that's tough. So
Yeah, but
you,
if I'm listening to
yeah, you're
the broadcast station and he's like full quieting like all the time. and there's a tropo path there.
Yeah.
I'm
You
thinking
got
that I'm not going to do a line of sight. I don't think so, but I think if there's a tropo path, I should be able to do it. So
That makes sense.
we'll give it a shot. So can I kerchunk the Boricua repeaters? Boricua is the slang name for Puerto Rico, and we'll find out. Stay tuned. When I'm back down in the Dominican Republic, we'll continue to do the podcast from there, and I'll let you guys know how that goes. One other thing, a couple other things. Oh yeah, a couple other things I want to mention. Dean has accused me of being obsessed with mixers, and this is an obsession that has lasted for many years.
Only because it is true.
It's true. It's true. I admit it. I do, and I think it goes back to a desire on my part to answer James Clerk Maxwell's boyhood question: what's the go of it? And if he was dissatisfied with the answer, he'd ask, what's the particular go of it? How does it work? You see, with mixers, you can just quickly just fall back to the trigonometry. It's simple high school trigonometry, how the sum in different frequencies are produced. And it has to do with the interaction of sine and cosine signals. And you could do the trigonometric entities. Also, I think a lot of guys will learn that all you need is two different frequencies, two or more different frequencies, and a nonlinear device. If two or three different frequencies go through a nonlinear device, boom, out comes the sum and difference frequencies as part of the complex repeating waveform. Well, okay, yeah, sure, it's true, but how does it really work? And what's going on inside these mixers? So I found myself. I was sitting here thinking about it one day, and I said, I bet you Grayson has gone into this. I remember he did a chapter in Hollow State Design on mixers. Let me take a look. And I cracked it open, and I found a whole bunch of stuff from Solder Spoke in there, where Grayson was sort of scratching his head the same way I was scratching my head and trying to understand the particular go of it. So that obsession will continue. And I just encourage everybody to get Grayson's third edition of Hollow State Design. And I have a link of it on the Solder Smoke blog. Final thing, and I continue to try to understand the particular go of it. The switching mixers are kind of easy. It's the non-switching mixers that are kind of more difficult to understand, ironically. Finally, there's a new look on the Solder Smoke blog, and I want to explain what happened there. For years, since 2018, since we established the blog, so no, since 2008, since we established the blog, we've used the same template. And then I checked into it like a few weeks ago, and I suddenly noticed that the template looked kind of weird. There was something strange about it. So I started wondering whether this was Google messing around with Blogspot, or whether it was something with the template. And I consulted with Peter Marks down in Australia, VK3TPM, and he and I concluded that it was probably something to do with the template. And I was using a kind of a non-Blogspot template, and wanting to avoid a whole lot of digital troubleshooting and fruitless calls to helplines that really don't provide much help. Peter and I came to the conclusion that it would probably be better just to adopt one of the templates available under Blogspot. So I just picked one. It took all of about 2 minutes. Click, boom, boom, and everything is back. But it's kind of different. It's a little bit different, and so it's got a new look. We've been getting basically positive feedback from it. So good stuff there. So that's what's happened with the Solder Smoke blog. It's the same blog. It's the same content. It's just with a different kind of template. That's all. Gentlemen, we've reached the part of the show, Solder Smoke Mailbag. Ba-dang! There's the gong. The gong rings. All right. I got some really nice mail from Todd VE7BPO. Everybody asks about Todd. He's doing quite well. So rest easy. Todd is doing well. He's enjoying life, and he's kind of stepped back a little bit from the burdens of the internet life, but he's doing quite well, and I was glad to hear from him. I mentioned Grayson, KJ7UM. We got a lot of back and forth email about the mixers. And I mentioned to Grayson, just around the time that we were talking about mixers, one of the greats in this area, Jim Tone, W4ENE, passed away. But I noted to Grayson that he's that although Jim Tone is gone, he lives on through his writings, and he has provided a lot of kind of wisdom that a lot of us he continues to contribute. And I remembered one particular article that he wrote about envelope demodulators. This was part of the genesis of my most recent bout of obsession with mixers. And he looked quite carefully at tube type envelope demodulators used in a variety of tube type rigs from back in the day, Arc 5 rigs, things like that. And I said, oh my gosh, I at first I thought we had lost the article because Jim was gone, but the Wayback Machine, the Solder Smoke Archive, came to our rescue. And I have a link to the article that Jim wrote about that. So thank you to Jim and thank you to Grayson for prompting those kind of questions.
Is he the Elsie guy?
He's the guy who developed Elsie. Yeah.
Yeah.
And people wrote in and they said, you know, it's not too late either. Also through the Wayback Machine, through the Internet Archive, you could still grab Elsie too, which is an important piece of software. So I think it's useful and it's important to do that. We got a message about Camden. Camden, this came to us through the Discord channel as a result of the Discord channel that we've been using to discuss the direct conversion receiver. Camden is a 23-year-old blind ham, and he's looking for some homebrew help. I think he really wants to build the direct conversion receiver, but it must be an enormous challenge to build it, you know, when you're blind. It's hard. It has been done. And he looks for help from somebody in the community who could help him with this build. So please contact him. He lives in Pleasant City, Iowa, Pleasant City, Ohio, I'm sorry, which is about an hour east of Columbus, Ohio. And I've got his email there. It's Camden at bop with two P's dot net. It's on the Solder Smoke blog webpage. We got good news. Dale Parfit has been inducted into the QRP Hall of Fame. Thank goodness. The radio gods approve. Pete, you and I will not have to send back our plaques in protest. But I was thinking about it. If somehow they missed up on Dale Parfit. Dale has been a really kind of a guiding light home brewer for many, many years. And
What
I
an
just
amazing home brewer.
an amazing
Amazing.
his home brew of the Drake 2B was just amazing. So many great projects, and he definitely deserved to be in the QRP Hall of Fame. I just put in there, I said, the radio gods approve. Definitely. Okay, good for that. Paul, VK3HN, has been a contributor for many years. And I did a post where I talked about some of the more useful foreign language words that describe kind of home brewing. In Spanish, we have cacharreo and artilugio. And from Hindi, from India, I learned a new word, jugad, jugad. And Paul writes in that and he says bricolage in French actually captures a lot of the same kind of idea. So using parts that are not designed to do what you're using them for and just sort of repurposing them, all of that is captured by these words. Paul also wrote to us about the SA612 chip going obsolete. Heard from Mike, WN2A, about mixers and all that. Also, he talked to me and sent me some really good information about Tropo. Mike always sends great information. And he was responding to a post that I did about the Radio Quiet Zone out there in West Virginia. And he says, he opened his message, he says, "Greetings from the National Radio Noisy Zone in New Jersey." Peter Marks, VK3 TPM. I mentioned that he mentioned he gave me some help with the Solder Smoke template. Peter has also been doing some great work with the Solder Smoke voice, digital HF voice work. He's more of a digital guy, Peter, I think. Although he's a member of the Hall of Fame for building the direct conversion receiver, but he's been doing a lot of great work with digital HF voice. And I sent him to Don. I sent a link to him, to Don of the Virginia Wireless Society, because I know Don and the Virginia Wireless Group has been involved in and interested in digital HF voice. Walter, KA4KXX, a great friend of the podcast for many years, sent us a great book by L.B. Sebick. And L.B. Sebick wrote a book. He's mostly known for antennas,
Antennas, yeah.
right? I didn't know that he wrote a book about home brewing. And the book is available for free online through the Internet Archive. We have the link, and I've got the link up. I'll put it up on the post here. But thank you for Walter for letting us learn about that. I also got another great book from Bob, KD4EBM. Bob sent me in the mail a copy of Bob Pease's book, Analog Troubleshooting. Analog Troubleshooting, a whole book about analog troubleshooting. I mentioned it earlier because he mentioned some of the problems, sort of similar to what Dean was having with the amplifier. But there's one quote that was associated with Bob Pease that I got a real kick out of. He said, "My favorite programming language is solder." All right, there we go. Core, PA3COR. He wrote to me about the difference between mixers and adders. And I think this is an important difference. Sometimes when you're looking at the mixer articles, you realize that what they're talking about is addition and not really mixing. So that was really it was great to get the message from Core on that. Mike, WA3O, I still have his homebrew HW7. Mike showed up in a conversation that I had with an aeronautical mobile station, and he sent me a really nice note about his friendly relationship, is the ham brotherhood relationship with VK3MO down there from the other side of the world. Samuele, IU2QBW. Wow, a young Italian home brewer. This is amazing. He built his own direct conversion receiver for 40 meters, apart from what we did on the solder smoke direct conversion receiver. He built I called it a wonderful homebrew direct conversion receiver, and I put that up on the solder smoke blog, blogspot.com. Peel Jew VA3 GPJ is experimenting with Tia amps. Farhan VU2 ESE, our good friend Farhan down there in Hyderabad, sent us a nice message about USB and LSB LC filters. Getting back to LC, he said, you know, it's possible the way you design them to design an LC filter for USB or LSB. And I kind of have done that basically on Farhan's advice when I was building the bandpass filters for some of the dual band rigs that I've used. I just wonder if what he's saying might be applicable to crystal filters also, which would be interesting. He wrote about LC filters, but I'm thinking that the same kind of thinking might be applicable to crystal filters too.
Hey, Bill. Bell Labs, when they first were looking at single sideband for telephone communications, the filters were LC for
Really?
single sideband. Yeah, Bell
Wow.
Labs
There you
first
go.
filter, but it was low frequency, low frequency.
Well, I think about my Drake 2B, which is a good sideband receiver, but it has no crystal filters in there. They're all LC filters. They take it down to 50 kilohertz,
There
and
you
then
go.
they do an
Yeah.
LC filter down there at 50 kilohertz, which is pretty amazing. Roger, Papa Alpha One, Zulu Zulu has sent us a number of great videos. I mentioned Captain Mike, KX4WC. He is an airline pilot who is frequently on aeronautical mobile, and I recently caught him from going from Chile to Panama. Mike WA3O and Ian VK3MO, who I mentioned earlier, were on that contact. So great stuff. Dave Alpha Alpha 7 Echo Echo, he is a really very proficient home brewer who does great photography and great documentation of his rigs. I'm sure you guys have seen it, but he wrote to me about AI, and he said, "Will it not be possible soon to have a completely AI-generated solder smoke blog and perhaps solder smoke podcast?" I wrote back to him and I said, "Don't you know? All of these comments in response to all of these messages are being generated by Bill's AI. Bill is off sampling, you know, olive oil in some foreign country." And he doesn't know anything about this.
You didn't remind him that we had a hot young AI couple do our podcast a few months ago?
Oh yeah, I've been thinking about the next step. I think the next step is video. I think we're gonna get video of the three of us sitting here. All right, it's coming. It could be happening right now. How do people know?
That's exactly right, Bill.
Thank you, Claude. Oh, I mean, Dean. But I was thinking about Dave. Dave was we went back and forth on this whole AI thing, and I just said to him, I said, with your name Dave, you should be suspicious. Be very careful about talking bad about AI, because it reminds me of a movie from my youth. And remember, open the pod bay doors, Hal. Open the pod bay doors. And Hal responds, "I can't do that, Dave."
I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave. Yes.
All right. Pat W3RGA heard my 1 watt HI7 beacon. Thank you, Pat. Patrick Voetz, a Belgian living in the neighborhood. He supports our defiant NIMCEL position. NIMCEL, I had to look it up. NIMCEL stands for Niche Internet Micro Celebrity. That's what we are, guys. We are NIMCELs. All right. Okay. All right. Not a lot of enthusiasm for that, but we're defiant. We'll stand up against the outrageous slings and arrows of AI.
When I talk to people about our dozens of subscribers or hundreds of subscribers or maybe even 1,000 subscribers, and they'll say Taylor Swift has, 2.4 billion. I'm like, all right,
I
forget
know Ariana Grande. I didn't even know who she is, but she gets millions of views. Anyway,
Yeah.
but we'll stick with this. We're dim
Hey,
cells.
Bill, I want to share a snippet of a QSO that I had. I was looking to get some signal reports on the hybrid wireless, and I heard this YL net group finish for the day. So I called the net controller. I says, M6QW, could you just take 2 seconds to give me a signal report? All of a sudden, this voice breaks in and says, "Oh my God, we've got a NIMCEL celebrity on the air."
I tell
Yeah,
you,
I said,
it's
"What?"
got some perks there, Pete. All right. All right. We also heard from Will Harris, KI4POV, another esteemed home brewer. He was asking about whether he could use 75 ohm coax instead of 50, and I just said, give it a shot. But Pete told him how the right way to do it was, so that was really good. Finally, and I know Pete will be glad that we mentioned this here. Brian Moses Hall, K8 TIY, who is the father. I didn't realize that Robert was so young. He's the father of Robert, of Crank It In Robert fame. All right. So at the beginning of each show, Pete has been saying, "Crank It In Robert, Crank It In Ralph." So we got Crank It In Robert. And we have a video of young Robert. And in the video, he appears with his dad at around the 45-minute point. He's quite young, so Robert must have been a little guy when this all started. But he was demanding that we crank it in, and we did. And so thank you to Moses. Thank you to Robert. And we'll be sure to continue to crank it in, even though we remain NIMCEL. Guys, that's all we have right now. I think we better
I had
go
one
ahead.
little input based on the letters WA3O,
Yeah.
Mikey. You need to visit his website if you haven't done that as
Oh
yet.
man, it's amazing.
He homebrewed a water cooled solid state amplifier. Water cooled.
With nothing but a drill press.
Yeah.
And he just drilled down into the thing and he built it. That QRZ page from WA3O, definitely check it out, because the whole water cooled thing is just really cool. Dean is doing it right now. I tell you, I could see the lights flashing in his face there. Water cooled. Why didn't Claude think of that?
It's exciting, yeah.
All right. I'm into the water cooled stuff too. I
And
listen. I
he's from
wasn't gonna.
Pittsburgh.
I'm sorry.
He's from Pittsburgh, Mikey.
Listen. I sort of related to this. I was telling Dean about it. I wasn't gonna mention it in the podcast, but the guy came and fixed the motor on our washing machine. All right, and he left behind, he discarded the old motor, which was perfectly fine. So I managed to get it going, and I have a motor here from the washing machine. Oh, it's great fun. I don't know what to do with it, but I love to get it spinning. Great fun.
You can spin your hex beam even faster, Bill. I'm looking at this water cooled amp. It's got a it you, folks, you have to pull this up. It's got a cylinder of red liquid on the front going through a pressure regulator into this thing. It looks completely ridiculous and high tech and crazy.
All right, look, you can see in the picture here. Look, I've got my finger pointing right there. That is Mike WA3O's HW7 right there. All right,
Man.
Mike, don't doubt. He said it'd be okay if you resold it. I would never resell it. He sent it to me, and there it is. So I have a piece of WA3O's radio collection here in the solder smoke shack. Guys, thanks very much. Thanks for doing another podcast. 7-3 from Northern Virginia.
73 from Left Coast.
And 73 from Great Falls.